Welcome once again to EWTN's Bookmark. I'm Doug Keke, your host. Our guest author, Father Christopher J. Seith, his book Rekindling Wonder, Touching Heaven in a Screen-Saturated World, available through our EWTN religious catalog, EWTNRC.com, for all things Catholic. Welcome, Father Chris.
If I could call you that, Father Chris. Please, yes.
People would have saw you on when you were on with on Life on the Rock there. And it was kind of funny because in reading your book and commenting on it, you saw the abbreviation of LOTR, which we use for Life on the Rock. And you were saying, oh, Lord of the Rings,
very exciting.
That's right, which was right in there.
That's
so is this your first book?
It is, yes.
Okay, what made you decide to write this book?
Well, that's a great question. I was interested in the topic. I wrote my dissertation on this topic. And then working with seminarians, working with young people, there is just this sense that, people need to be able to encounter God, and they're losing that ability in our world.
Right. Well, one of the things that's interesting, because you said a screen-saturated world, so this is definitely something you think is really relevant to what you see going on today, but yet it's just a symptom of some other things that have always existed, right?
Exactly.
It's just another version of it.
Right. Yep. No, it's this, right, flight from self, the attempt to have control over things so that we're not so vulnerable to just the experience of living in a fallen world. And yeah, our screens just have such a capacity to distract us, have such a capacity to alienate us from ourselves and others.
Right. Are you surprised as somebody, you probably grew up basically in the computer age. I'm assuming you were pretty well. You know, I remember typewriters and Selectrics and things like that and word processors. So I'm a little predated. I'm still
a little jealous.
I'm still sitting there doing the three finger punch. But this is something that you grew up with. Are you surprised it's had the impact it's had?
I'm really not. No. Growing up with it, there was always this sense that something is off. Mm-hmm. Super useful, right? So obviously, but something just, it doesn't surprise me.
Right. Yeah. Now, you were in the beginning, you talk about beauty and things like that, Our Lady, but you also in the beginning talk about screw tape, and it was interesting, you talk about a follow-up to the screw tape letters. Mm-hmm. Explain. I wasn't even actually familiar with this.
So at the end of screw tape letters, often when you read screw tape letters, they're put together, but years after Lewis finished the screw tape letters, he wrote a toast that Screwtape gives to the new graduates of this, you know, the demons school.
The tempters,
exactly.
Right. The tempters, right.
And it's a very disturbing toast, as you can imagine, a demon giving a toast. And he says that they've been feasting on the souls of the damned, but it's not very delightful. They don't taste like anything. They're just very bland and dull.
And why are they bland and dull?
Yeah, that there's such a, just, I don't even know how to put it, but before, right, there's like everybody's plunging into sin, they're excited about sin, and now there's just a neutered humanity,
right.
And so there's not really any excitement in sin.
Right.
It's just sort of people are doing it, and so they're falling into hell, but it's just not this like...
Right. Yeah, they're just strolling in rather
they're
than
just,
diving
yeah,
in,
yeah.
And so it's boring, you say.
Right, right.
They don't like boring, apparently.
No. But for them, it gets more people there, so that's all that matters.
So what's a noonday demon?
The noonday demon is, so this was a term from the Desert Fathers to describe the demon that shows up to basically just to dull everything, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's...
Which is what they're complaining about.
Right,
everything's
exactly,
too dull.
Exactly.
Okay,
this noonday demon just is having his way. And so the noonday demon shows up to make us sorrowful and slothful in view of spiritual things, right? We have to get mad, we have to wake up early to go pray. We have to, and it's just this, ugh, right? Or I have to go pray. Oh, I should go attend to these other things.
Right.
And underneath of it is
you may know your friend who never cleaned up his room unless he had to write a paper.
That's exactly right. Yes.
And suddenly found that was much better. First, when I read it, I thought, did he need that so he could write his paper? Then I realized, oh, this is to avoid writing his paper. Because a lot of this is avoidance, isn't it?
That's right.
And you really talk about what you think you're avoiding, but you're actually avoiding something else.
Right. We think we're avoiding some difficult thing. We think we're avoiding. Right, you know, who knows what, mm-hmm. but in reality what we're avoiding is the experience of living in relation and suffering our own humanity, right? This need to be, really it's the fear of loneliness, it's the sadness of not being in relationship
right.
that we're avoiding.
And who is it we ultimately need to be in relationship
right.
with?
God. It's God, of course.
Yeah. Now, why are digital devices such a big part of this?
Yes, so the way I see it is our digital devices, they're so tempting because they incline us, or they make us think like, oh, well, if I have this, I can always be with people. Mm-hmm. And so it presses into this desire we have to be in a relationship. The problem is that because it's always at our fingertips, mm-hmm. it actually disposes us away from being in a relationship with others, because any real relationship with depth is something that isn't at my fingertips. I have to receive another's love. Mm-hmm. And so our devices keep us from being receptive mm-hmm. Because they're so convenient.
Is it also a way of keeping people at a distance?
So if there's, yeah, exactly, right? You mm-hmm. have a difficult conversation and it's like, oh, I don't like this. And so I can just check out, mm-hmm. right? I can go to my phone or, yeah.
Or know. I can have that conversation over my phone.
Exactly.
So if it goes the wrong way, I can just kind of back out.
That's it.
Right. Yep. You said we must no longer think of ourselves as being distinct from our digital devices. Transhumanists envision a world in which human brains are merged with computers. None of this would be particularly disturbing if it were not for the fact that by conforming ourselves to digital devices, we lose the capacity to find joy in reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everything has to be more exciting. I mean, my heart goes out to, so I help out at a college seminary. Mm-hmm. So I'm often on a college campus, and my heart goes out to like the young women who, in order to attract men to them, have to wear these, you know, just such provocative things mm-hmm. because men are no longer able to just be amazed by the beauty of a woman. Mm-hmm. You know, a sunset isn't exciting enough. We have to digitally manipulate it to make it more exciting, mm-hmm. you know?
But what's interesting with that, and I think we find because of the human capacity to take in and acquire things and make them something they already own, is you can go to you go to the beach mm-hmm. and you can't believe the view for the beach. It's yeah. unbelievable. But after you're there for a day mm-hmm. or a day or two, you don't notice as much. It doesn't right. impact you as much.
Right. That's the challenge is how do we stay in a posture where we can constantly be amazed again at reality.
Now you talk about traps and souls in its snare that the demons do, but then you say there's something refreshing. This sounds very Catholic. There's something very refreshing about becoming aware of one's own misery.
Yes. Fair. I think, so my mom has a lot of health issues and a connective tissue disorder. And and so when finally the doctors were able to diagnose it, there was this relief, like, oh, there's something wrong with me. Mm-hmm. And I think we all experience this where
there's an answer
in that way, oh, it's okay that I'm miserable because there's something wrong here.
I see.
Yeah.
Now you say actually we can have a sense of oppression from our devices. What would be an mm-hmm. example in your mind of that?
So that we can, I guess one of the things that I'm thinking of there is that they're constantly calling to us. Mm-hmm. So they're designed intentionally to draw us into them, right?
Right.
And so we feel a certain burden to like attend.
And even have a positive chemical reaction, which has
exactly.
been.
Right, exactly. Right. And so there's this oppression of like, I'm constantly at the beck and call of my phone, mm-hmm. just in case someone reaches out, just in case that email comes through, whatever it is. And it's just oppressive. Like we're not able to live in the freedom of the moment.
Mm-hmm. Do you think also in some of these things, as far as that people, as you talk about, a CD in a sense of, mm-hmm. of staying away and kind of not doing what you're supposed to be doing, but when we're on the device, we convince ourselves we're actually accomplishing something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
At least I'm on my device,
right.
And so I'm actually doing something
right.
here.
Which I think points to this thought that if I'm not being productive, my life has no value.
Okay.
Right? So in order to justify this moment, I have to be doing something. Mm-hmm. Rather than, right, the child who's able to just rest, and he doesn't have to justify himself. He knows the love of mm-hmm. his parents, and so there's not this sense of I have to be doing.
Right. You say that by looking to Jesus Christ and renouncing the lure of the world, we are set free from the life of boredom. No longer will our souls make demons gag. Rather, ours will be souls which will fill them with hatred and fear while shining like stars in the sky in the midst of a darkened world. And then you go on to quote, you know, Romans, St. Paul, do not be conformed to this world, but to be transformed by the renewal of your minds. The other thing you talk about is really the fact of the attraction to beauty, and that at many times in the world we're living in today, there's actually a rejection of that.
Yes. Yeah, there's a flight from beauty, because in beholding beauty, there's a couple things happen, but one is we want to be part of it, and so there's this longing that comes upon us, and we realize that this world is not enough for us. But the other thing is that we're convicted by beauty, because we realize how we do not conform to it, right? And so if we're not willing to convert and to have our hearts stretched in longing, we run away from that experience. And so I think a lot of our culture right now is inflate from the beauty of Christianity.
Right. And you talk about, I thought it was interesting, you talk about, it must have been an experience of those who encountered Jesus of Nazareth, you know, that idea of him in person and seeing the reaction of those people who followed him, the beauty that was there,
You get the sense they're drawn.
They're
clearly captivated by his beauty. I mean, John Paul's encyclical, Veritatis Splendor, right? The splendor of truth that people saw in Jesus.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. Now, the other point to tie into Lord of the Rings, you talk about the idea of the ring and the idea that indeed, even in the hands of the virtuous, the ring has power to corrupt its bearers. And is that the same thing you see with technology?
I think so, yeah. It's so, we have to, so they're not designed in a certain sense to be used virtuously.
They're designed to be used virtually.
That's
where we moved into.
Yes. And so we have to use them in a way that's other than how they're intended to be used. Because they are super helpful, very useful.
Right.
But gosh, they can really suck us in.
Suck you in. You talk about living differently and two forms of living differently, one that's a spirit of sadness and one with joyful hope and confidence. How does one find the right path,
So in the encounter with beauty, we don't just go back to our lives before that. Either we live in flight from that, or we choose to believe in the promise that's been offered us in beauty. And so I think living, ultimately it's the virtue of hope, that we live in hope for fulfillment. And so we don't settle for lesser alternatives.
Right, but yet that's what we're being convinced of. A demon hidden in plain sight and known as the noonday devil or acedia casts a cloud of sadness over reality and so deludes the citizens into thinking that life is really not that good.
Right. And so we have to artificially manufacture things that make us think life is good and exciting and worthy of beholding.
Right, and that leads to other vices.
All sorts.
Which are some of them are pretty obvious. I didn't realize, though, that there was a big problem with related to acedia and broccoli.
Well, who would know, right?
That's right.
So I used this example of the child looking at broccoli, and he's saddened. After he's just had this great dinner, he's looking forward to dessert, and he sees broccoli, and he's just like, oh. And he doesn't want to eat it. And so on the one hand, there's this repulsion from activity. On the other hand, that child will do all sorts of things to distract himself. You know, he might play with the broccoli, he might anything to keep him from eating this.
Right.
Which is a good symbol of when we behold the spiritual good, and we see it as distasteful because it's difficult. We run away from that, and so there's this lack of activity, but also we do all sorts of things to distract ourselves.
And that's why you ask the question, why would friendship with God be a source of sadness?
Right, I know, you'd think this is amazing.
Right, you would think you'd see it and you'd run towards it, but it's almost so overwhelming that you realize how far away from it you are that you tend to maybe back away.
So some of the spiritual authors talk about acedia as spiritual pusillanimity, which is a false humility, right? Like, oh, that's too high for me.
Right. You say, after beholding the beauty of God for a moment, we come back down to earth and realize that we fall far from that glory, which is what I was saying.
Yeah.
You also talk about we may find friendship with God to be dissonant with our nature is because of the need for the humble acceptance of divine aid.
Yeah.
So we have to admit that we can't do it ourselves.
That's right. That's right. Which is very difficult to do, right? We are so, and again, the thought is, well, if I just have enough technology to augment my power, then I'll be able to take care of myself. And beholding beauty, we realize, oh no, I will only be fulfilled in relationship, but that requires another's gift of self. And I'm not in control of that. And so we don't like that either.
So you think Nietzsche was a genius?
He had some really good things to say, obviously. Also, he had some kind of crazy things.
Yeah, didn't end up too well, but.
But I think he rightly understood the modernity's problem, right? And so he has this insight where he says, in order to find joy in anything, we must approve of everything. And what he means by that is not like everything is okay, but just there has to be this underlying affirmation of the goodness of reality in order to celebrate any particular thing. How can we celebrate someone's birthday as a good thing if we think, like Jean-Paul Sartre, that it's absurd that we were born?
We were even born in the first place, and life has no meaning. Love expands one's vision to see the mystery of reality. The person wholly overcome by Aesthetes' influence, however, who loves nothing and no one, loses the capacity to see more than what can be empirically verified. Is that the very materialistic idea we have today?
That's exactly right. Okay. We've reduced our vision to what can be kind of mathematically understood. But everyone who's been in love knows, all right, we can never actually encompass what we behold. And so again, it's acedia is this flight from love, right? It's this living without that vision. And we've reduced reality to these,
Now you said acedia has daughters. And one of them, I think we talked a little bit about effectively, we talked about flight from beauty. The other one was despair, which I think you see front and center in the world we live in today.
Very much, yeah. So just, it's, you know, we know that suicide rates are up among the young.
Absolutely.
It's pretty clear, but also this sense that like my life has no meaning. What am I doing this for? And we've just lost the plot, right? We don't know where we're headed anymore. And so there's just despair.
Was that the loss of the sense of the eternal?
Exactly.
In that sense that there's something beyond me?
Yes, exactly. You
say despair is closely related to anxiety. And we see this in a natural level. How so?
Anxiety and depression go hand in hand. That when you lose sight of the goal, everything is overwhelming. It's just this, I have to attend to everything because I don't know what I can bring into my life that will get me towards my goal and what to let go of. And so every experience is so overwhelming because we have no orienting principle for ourselves.
Right, and in the flight from beauty you talk about in our day, we seem to find a repugnance towards the sacred. We want everything to belong to the sphere of the workaday world, to the everyday and to the commonplace in our lives. You think that's why there are more and more people looking for maybe even from the mass and things like these things that come across as otherworldly? And people are looking for that kind of thing, even just interest in near-death experiences and miracles and those kind of things, to say there is something more beyond this world.
There's such a draw, especially among the young people, to just the sacred. They want to know there's something other than this. Shia LaBeouf, right, gave that, interview where he said, like, don't try to sell me anything, you know? Take me out of this world when I go to Mass.
Right, exactly. You know, you talk about distraction, also a certain unrest and wandering of the mind towards artificial and harmful pleasures. We see, for example, someone mindlessly surfing the web would be an example of that, right?
Just trying to numb out, right, to get rid of anything, and so we're just scrolling again and again, just to avoid this sadness, this emptiness.
Right. And to feel, as, like you said, as in a sense, what we talked about, as if I'm accomplishing something. You also talk about here, I thought, in naming the darkness, chapter one, he may well be lazy, but no one would call him restful. I thought that was a really interesting insight. Explore that.
Sure. Yeah. So in order for someone to really rest, he has to be at peace with who he is. We've been around people that have this rest, right? People who are lazy aren't doing anything, but they're interiorly at flight from themselves, so they don't have that capacity to be restful. And so it's so difficult because like the work that's required for us to be at peace with ourselves disposes us to really enter into rest, and we're just avoiding all of that.
Right. And then anxiety never is restful.
Exactly.
That's it. Chapter two, you talk about digital seduction. Now, I always thought The Sorcerer's Apprentice was written by Walt Disney, myself, and that Mickey starred in it, but you've got Goethe here.
Goethe,
or something.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Why don't you talk a little bit about why you told that story?
Yeah, so Goethe, so it's this, right, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, and this apprentice does this magic thing on, magic spell on a broom in order to, on a mop to clean things up more quickly, but it gets out of hand.
Right.
And he doesn't have control over the spell anymore. And I use that as an image of what's taken place in our use of our phones, that the people that created these things are starting to realize, oh my gosh, this has taken on a life of its own.
Right.
And we're not in control anymore.
And you talk about that documentary and some of the people
featured
in that.
Yep.
I had seen that as well, that particular documentary. Mm-hmm. You talk about we do not feel more connected to our world, actually, surprisingly, but less.
Yes. Yeah, and I think a good example of this is, the screens in our cars, which are really helpful. They help you park, but you end up playing a video game when you're parking now.
That's true.
Actually being immersed in the world, we're just looking at a screen and it perfectly sets things up. So everything is very functional, but we feel less a part of the world that we inhabit.
Now, you also talk about technology and vulnerability. So on the other side, you talk about the idea that there's a certain amount of riskiness that we feel an inherent danger we want to see in this world. And you quote C.S. Lewis at the end. He says, the only place outside heaven where you can be perfectly safe from all dangers and issues of love is hell.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. When the experience of love makes one vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Anyone who's been in love knows this experience, and we want to be vulnerable, right? We want to have the experience of not being in control, the experience of falling in love. And so we have all these ways of trying to manufacture that experience because we want it. And the alternative to that, to vulnerability, is getting closed in on ourselves, which for C.S. Lewis is just another way of saying this is hell. Being closed within the confines of my own mind, right? Not letting anything take me out of myself because I'm safe there, right? If something takes me out of myself, I don't know what's gonna happen, but I can stay safe in myself.
Do you see a lot of that with younger people really be a function of lack of trust?
So much, yeah. There's been such a wounding of that trust, right, growing up. I mean, just in families and the brokenness of our culture, of all sorts of things.
Even in the church,
exactly, right?
Kind of authority figures finding out later, not really, and that really wasn't the best idea.
And so we're not able to find security in relationships anymore. And so we try to find security in other ways.
Right, and people are afraid to risk, right?
Right.
In chapter four, Divine Conquest, you say G.K. Chesterton describes St. Francis as someone who looked at the world as though he were standing upside down. Explain.
G.K. Chesterton, it's this great image of he sees everything as though it's dependent on God, right? If you were to see things hanging upside down, you'd be like, how? That's amazing. How is that not falling to the ground, right? How is that, what's keeping this in place? And Francis just had, because of his vow of poverty, he had this awareness that everything's dependent on God. And so he lived life differently, as though he were upside down.
Right. So in the acknowledgments, you talk about this book being a fruit of many years' work. How many years was that?
Yeah, I mean, I began it in 2011 is when I really started.
So 11, 10, 11
years. So yeah, about
years,
11, 12 years.
10 years. Yeah. You said, I began with an impossible task, that of expressing my gratitude to my family. And obviously you say you had a saintly mother and father, your sister, etc. Why is it impossible to express to your
My gratitude. Because in order to express it, you'd have to have lived with me, right? You have to have the same heart as I have. There's some things that are inexpressible.
Right.
And
you'd have to be vulnerable.
Very much.
Right, yes. Be able to do it. And you also, to thank those who had to endure the random outbursts of excitement or heartbreak during my time of writing the book. So did you have some random outbreaks?
Yes. The seminarians at JP2 Seminary know well. The joy that I would have in their hatred for their smartphones or the sadness that I would see.
So you had a lot of people, based on this, read this over and over again. So did they make lots of suggestions and ways to change it?
Absolutely, yeah. There was a lot of Or more so just ways of helping me see things or articulate things. Yeah.
Now, in your dedication, it's dedicated to Our Lady, and you talk about radiant beauty of the Incarnate Word.
Yeah. Yeah, it's right. Our Lady is such a beautiful antidote, I think. There's an Eastern icon called Platitera, which calls Mary more spacious than the heavens, because within her is the infinite, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think the whole reason I wrote this book is to help us be aware that there's more than this world that we are looking for.
Right. And you're working on another book, maybe?
So I'm working on a book on Joseph Pieper and what his wisdom has to offer to seminarians.
And why is he so wise in your mind?
Well, that's a great question. Pieper has this way of bringing forth the tradition of the church to moderns, basically, okay. of those who have experienced modernity and need a corrective lens in order to appreciate the beauty of Christian thought.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, stop by the next time.
I will. Thank you so
okay.
much, though. I appreciate
Thanks
it.
Thanks for stopping by, Father Christopher Seith. His book, Rekindling Wonder, Touching Heaven in a Screen, Saturated World, Don't We Know It? Available through our EWTN religious catalog, EWTNRC.com for all things Catholic. I'm Doug Keck. Thanks for stopping by. We'll see you next time right here on Bookmark. Thank you.